Welcome to Worlds Apart. Western media are now awash with gloomy forecasts for the coming winter and the sobering lifestyle changes that many Europeans will have to make in order to get through it. But European reliance on Russian energy wasn't just a short-sighted political folly. It's the fundamental economic factor on which the entire economy of the Eurozone depends. It's part of a foundation on which European prosperity was built. Can Europe replace that foundation without damaging the building on top of it? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Glenn Deason, professor at the University of Southeastern Norway. Professor Deason, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
And it's a bit of a surprise for me to speak to a Western academic at a Russian conference because, you know, the exchanges, even the intellectual exchanges between the Russians and the Westerners are not really encouraged at this point of time. Aren't you concerned about any political or career repercussions for speaking to RT?
Well, luckily I work for a university which is quite strong on defending academic freedom. So they pretty much given me the right to do as I please within certain boundaries, of course. I guess the main problem is in the media, where there's a greater push for controlling the narrative. This is where you find that Russian media is being censored, well, completely shut down. And also we find that our own media never really accommodates the Russian argument or presents even Russian interests. So it becomes a very difficult for academics to actually do their job in order to understand what's the challenge to Russia in order to explain what it's doing. So it's not a great time for academics in the West, I'm afraid.
I know that geopolitics and geoeconomics is your primary academic interest. It's your area of expertise. And you, for many years, you've been following on Russia's use of energy for its economy as well as in trade with other countries. We are speaking just days after Gazprom suspended all its gas supplies to Europe, citing technical malfunctions on the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. What does it mean for both sides?
Well, this is another step in the complete breakdown, I think, of the entire international economic system. It also is a very important component of this divorce between the West and Russia. Now, for some time, the West has been wanting to cut its reliance on Russian energy because in the international system, what you want to have asymmetrical interdependence. That is, you want other to be dependent on you, but you shouldn't be dependent on them. So again, Russia has been dependent on Western technologies, industries, transportation corridors, banks, currencies, insurances, payment systems. So across the board, the one problem for the West has we've been reliant on Russian energy.
And as well as Russian agricultural.
And yes, agriculture as well. So the problem now, of course, is by reducing or cutting reliance on Russian gas and oil, we actually hurt our own economies, obviously, because often we treat this idea that we're buying Russian energy as some kind of a charity to Russia. But of course, this is if we want competitive industries in Europe, the key ingredient is always cheap energy. So cheap energy resources, cheap metals and different resources. And we kind of always got this from Russia. Again, this has been through all of history.
It started not only in recent times. It started actually during the height of the Cold War. And yet at that time, both sides respected their contracts and respected what you actually called the balance of dependence. This is a term that Vladimir Putin, the president of this country, used to refer a lot, but he also was making a point that in order for this balance of dependence to function properly, it needs to be mutually respected and appreciated. Do you think the Europeans fully understood and appreciated their reliance on Russia's energy? Because it gave them an enormous competitive advantage. I mentioned that their prosperity, at least in Germany, was built on it. I don't think it's an exaggeration.
No, and I think it's obvious that it wasn't appreciated, because if you saw the rhetoric back in February, March, the argument was, well, we don't need Russian gas and oil. We can cut it completely and we'll be just fine. But as we discovered, we're not fine. All the industries have depended on this, the entire competitiveness. So even if it was possible to reduce reliance on Russian energy, it will nonetheless be importing LNG and other more expensive source of energy, so which means that our industries will be less competitive, especially the Germans. And so the long-term repercussions are staggering. But in reality, I don't think we're even able to replace cheap Russian gas with expensive from other places. So. I think after this, probably there will be a bit more appreciation.
Can I ask you something? Because it's very hard for us, the Russians, to understand that. You know, we have this saying, measure seven times and cut once. When we are talking about a massive, a fundamental economic issue, and yet this level of cooperation that existed for many decades was cut in a matter of a couple of months. Don't you think that the decision makers at least looked at the balance sheets? I mean, how would something like that be done in such a short period of time and with so little consideration for the effects of it on your own domestic economies?
Well, I think it's poor leadership, to be honest, because you know, especially from the German side, they have recognized that, you know, cutting, for example, Nord Stream 2 would be suicide, cutting off SWIFT would be suicide, and of course stealing the half of the reserves from the Russian central bank would also be horrible for trust. So, but I guess in the heat of the moment, when the emotions were running high, it became common sense, kind of became impossible. It's a lot of self-harm, because all the areas where Russia has been dependent on the West, it's kind of relied on trust. That is, you know, using Western technologies, banking system, all this. It relied on not just the Russians trusting the West, but what we're now seeing is, after these sanctions and cutting off, trying to destroy the Russian economy, the rest of the world is looking at the West, not, you know, with admiration that they're standing on principle, but the West is seen to be more rogue now in the international economic system. So the rest of the world, China, India, you know, all facing possible threats if they trade with Russia, they're now questioning, you know, is it safe to have our supply lines dependent on, you know, Western industries and technologies? Is it safe to use euros and dollars, to use SWIFT, use their banks? They're starting to, you know, question all of this. And this is why the economic system, which has been so centralized and Western-centric, is now fragmenting. So, you know, this should have been obvious. I mean, I've been warning since 2015, at least, that this is the direction we're moving. And I'm sure that, you know, the European leaders are also aware of this, that this is the direction we're heading. But nonetheless, the only impulse now is to double down. And we continue to do it, even though, you know, there are consequences keep piling on.
That's actually a very interesting question, because a few years ago, it was fashionable to use the terms of game theory, you know, non-zero-sum game, mutual benefits, you know, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. But it seems that even the whole idea of mutuality, if it's Russia or China deriving those benefits, is politically unacceptable right now. Have we come to the point when only the mutuality of harm, I harm myself in order to harm you, is politically admissible?
Yes, well, I guess to some extent it's always been like this. If you, you know, for example, if the United States can break the Chinese economy in half, it would be beneficial for the U.S. to do it, even if 10% of its own economy would be wiped out. So you always look at interdependence, you look at the relative
strength. But you would at least look at the gains for yourself.
Exactly,
but at this point of time, Russia is gaining from diverting its supplies to other markets.
And that's what makes this irrational, because, you know, let's say we're all on board, like it's a great thing to harm the Russian economy. Well, if this is the measurement we're going for, it's still, well, we're not achieving it, because it went from, you know, we cause a lot of pain to Russia and only small to us, and now we see it's been completely reversed. Now, these sanctions are actually hurting the West more than Russia. Like, one point of example is, you know, we're not going to buy Russian gas, so we buy it from LNG from China instead. Well, Russia's export, the sanctions on Russia keeps the energy price high. Russia exports to China. China takes a markup and exports to the EU. Russia's benefiting because the prices are pushed up. Russia can export less energy but still make much more money. All our leaders from US, Britain, EU, they all kind of bet their entire political legitimacy on this fight, that we were going to beat the Russians. But now, when it's all failing, they don't really have any other solutions rather than just double down?
Professor Dizon, this is actually, again, a very interesting question and perhaps even underexplored how much political mythology and rhetoric influence solid economic decisions, because here in Russia, we usually think of the Westerners as those, you know, hard-nosed capitalists who are good at procuring profits, who only mind their own business. But these days, again, our typical stereotypes of the Westerners are defied. What is the basic guiding principles of European and Western approach at this point of time? Not necessarily to Russia, but just the approach to policy, both domestic and international. What are the main values of the decision makers?
Well, I think it's holding on to this unipolar moment, which is already gone, because
And the unipolar moment, meaning that I'm the only one who is good and noble and entitled to making decisions?
Yes, so because the way the international system works is when all economic power is concentrated in one place, such as it was in the West in the 1990s, you have certain, you're very comfortable and you can, but you also have the incentive to build trusts because you're administrating the global economy. Now, the problem is when the hegemon declines, and it loses this hegemony, you see that the hegemon is more likely to use economic statecraft in order to punch down on other rising powers. So, for example, China, Russia, you know, we didn't have this kind of policies in the 90s, but as we use this economic levers of power to punish and prevent adversaries from rising, you know, you only create more incentive for the rest of the system to shed this reliance and dependence on the West. So I think this is, this is kind of the dynamic you're seeing, because the West has a dilemma. On one hand, we can just wait and see that, you know, power slips from our fingers, or we can use what we have left of economic power in order to try to, you know, crush our enemies, you know, enemies or at least adversaries, China and Russia. And it's not working. So.
But
it's,
there's also a third option. You can work with your so-called enemies to make sure that in the new world that is already being born, you can ensure the best positions for yourself, because as the heirs of the previous system, you still have an advantage over everybody else, don't you?
Yes, I actually argued this in a book in 2015. I was arguing that the U.S. and the collective West kind of had two different paths to take, because the unipolarity was over. And we had two options. We could either facilitate a multipolar order where the U.S. could be like the first among equals, but still accept there's a system based on multipolarity. Or we, the United States, had the option of trying to prevent the rise of other states. But in this instance, yes, you could prevent a multipolar order from developing itself, but then you'll probably see this multipolar order being developed in opposition to the United States. So you see the BRICS, so you see the China-Russia partnership. This has a very overt objective of containing or balancing the United States. And obviously, the first option would have been preferable. Even speaking of Brzezinski, he also recognized this dilemma in 2012, I think, and he also said he was no friend of Russia, I would add, and still he was recognizing that it's better now to make, for the U.S. to use its current influence to create a new system, a multipolar system, where it had a privileged place. But instead, yeah, we are where we are.
We have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Putin is on offense. Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
First time in history, an entire country's culture has been cancelled with a very modern weapon. Cancel culture.
Dell'idea secondo cui la Russia sia il male assoluto.
E мы были в шоке.
Честные соревнования, и тут вот такое вот.
The phrase now particularly refers to cancelling Russian culture.
Нет одного секрета всего русского.
Из розетки вынимаются все.
Мы тебя убьем. 30 человек высылают, готовы к тому, чтобы собрать чемодан и домой.
What Russia's created over the past 1500 years is now questioned, harshly condemned, reviled and rejected.
Все соревнования, они вообще ставятся под сомнение.
Это было прям тяжело.
È una cosa, è una colpa oggi in Italia, anche essere un russo morto.
The list joining total condemnation grows daily and now includes Dostoevsky, Tchaikovsky and Shostakovich.
Это они теряют русскую культуру.
Настоящие русские артисты всегда будут иметь успех.
Да там люди обомлеют.
La cultura è una cultura che ha contribuito allo sviluppo di tutto il mondo.
Worlds Apart with Glenn Dizon, a professor at the University of Southeastern Norway. Professor Dizon, before the break, we touched on multipolarity, and I think there is a difference in how this term is interpreted in the East and in the West. As I speak to the delegates at this forum, what they mean by multipolarity is the recognition that each country, even though there are some common laws of economy and, you know, social organization, etc., each country develops according to its own historic trajectory and at its own unique pace. And it's not about so much, you know, trying to push everybody in the same direction as the West tried to, or the United States tried to do for frankly, for its own benefit, but rather respecting the difficulties, the differences of various countries, and try to find, you know, a middle ground between that. And that's why I think I would disagree with your assumption that BRICS and all the other organizations of integration in Asia were built against the United States, because it looks like they're building a lot of mutual benefits to their members already.
Well, yes. Well, I would argue that they were not necessarily created only against the U.S. They were seen to be parallel institutions because the U.S.-centric institutions couldn't adapt to the emergence of multipolar power. If you take, for example, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the Chinese were trying to have the IMF reformed to the extent it could accommodate China more properly, in accordance with its relative power. But the United States was never really willing to reform in terms of the voting power. So, you know, the Chinese began to break away and they just established a parallel economic infrastructure. What I mean is that if the United States uses these organizations coercively against Russia, against China, then you will see these parallel institutions being used as a way of balancing the Americans.
Would it be fair to say that the main feature of those institutions, even though they pursue individual countries' interests, is mutuality, whereas the main feature of Western-dominated institutions is ultimately coercion? Sure, there's some soft power and some trying to entice, but when push comes to shove, it's always about coercion at the end.
Yeah, well, that's because they're unipolar. They're seeking to establish their dominance, which means, you know, use this asymmetrical interdependence to impose its will on other countries. So you mentioned before, you know, that the country, all the world should develop according to the Western model. This is the only reason you can have this ideology is because in the 90s it reflected the international power distribution. But power is really at the core, because, again, in the 90s when it was unipolar, if you would sanction, for example, Russia, then Russia would have to adjust or, you know, change its policies in order to get let back in to into the good graces of the West. The problem in the multipolar order is multipolar system is because you have different centers of power. If you put sanctions on Russia, then you're simply giving away huge market share. And this is the problem of the multipolar order. This is why it's important in the West to recognize the unipolarity is gone. The world is multipolar. That the tools of the unipolar order doesn't exist anymore.
Now, I understand why a unipolar world would be beneficial to the United States from a political and even economic point of view. But when it comes to history, when it comes to collective psychology, I simply cannot understand how anyone can assume that one collective psyche can develop in accordance or take the path of another collective psyche. I mean, we are all different, even on the individual level. I cannot be you, you cannot be me. Where does this idea that it is possible to develop countries as different from the United States as, let's say, China, Russia, Afghanistan, where this idea comes from that we can essentially be all like the Americans? It seems so stupid, to be honest with you, pardon my French.
Well, from like the realist theory perspective, I think everything derives from power. Even ideology is a reflection of power. When you're dominant, as the U.S. was in the 90s, it's very appealing to accommodate ideologies which promote universalism, because when you have a universalist idea, like the old world should develop in one specific way, it effectively means that, you know, they should develop in the American way. And the reason why universalism is appealing is because now, you know, the borders matter less. Now you have a system of sovereign inequality, and this is what you want when you're the dominant power. Because sovereign inequality means sovereignty for me, but not for you. So when we're talking about democracy promotion, it means I can interfere in your country, you can't interfere in mine. You know, I can topple governments, you can't. I can go to war, as long as you have this liberal democratic reasoning. This is something John Hertz pointed out in the 1940s. He said that often you find that the more countries are democratic domestically, the more they will resist international democracy, because we will see there as a need to protect the democracy from the majority, which again becomes a contradiction in terms. But again, I think it was Socrates who, you know, a long time ago, made this argument that, you know, I'm a citizen of the world. It had a good intention. We shouldn't have all these borders between us or them. But then you had Alexander the Great saying the same thing. Oh, I'm a citizen of the world, and then he expands an empire to the east. So,
but I can also be a citizen of the world respecting myself and respecting how different you are from me, and respecting the fact that if I scratch your back, you scratch mine. We may not get the maximum of what we want, but each one of us will get something, and at the end, the peace between us will benefit.
No, I agree, and I think that's why Russia probably looks at the rise of China with more comfort than the United States, because with the United States, it has this universalist hegemonic objective. But the Chinese, they're not suggesting that their development model should be exported to the rest of the world. So this universalist ideal, where they become the owners of this ideal, because this is really where the problem is. Because this, again, democracy, human rights, is all great concepts. But the problem is the United States and the collective West kind of tied all of this ideas to an entity of power, which are them. So this is the core of liberal hegemony. If they're saying the only way liberalism can survive is if we are in power. So yeah, we haven't really seen this from other rising powers such as China yet. So I think this is why the ideology becomes a very dangerous aspect. But it's also a reflection of power, I believe. Because if the U.S. reduces in power now, it will surely want to embrace new principles such as sovereign equality, mutual constraint, the things we began shedding in the early 1990s.
Well, some would argue that this may already be happening, at least in a sense that before, you know, even 5 years ago, the Americans, the Europeans, the allies were able to conduct whatever foreign policy they want without much cost to themselves. Nowadays, it hits home. It hits home in Europe. We discussed the difficulty of getting through the winter, the difficulty of actually finding a new foundation for the European economy, energy foundation, I mean. And also it hits home with Americans. There are major elections, midterm elections coming up in the United States. And it's clear that the Trump base is as strong as it was before, and perhaps even more intensified, more rageful. Do you think there will be any change in Western foreign policy because of the internal unrest, or do you think, on the contrary, foreign policy of the West is likely to get even more adversarial because they're facing difficulties at home?
It could go both ways. I mean, the German foreign minister just said that doesn't care what the Germans' voters say.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
It is, but she will, you know, support Ukraine no matter what the German voters say. This is an interesting development. But you also had this new push now the protests in Prague, where I think 70,000 people took to the streets arguing, let's have a more neutral role in this conflict.
Well, they were labeled as Russian sympathizers, but I agree with you that the numbers are pretty impressive.
Yeah, but I think it all depends on how this conflict's going to sort out, because at the moment you have two possible narratives. If the United States prevails and NATO prevails, then the narrative's going to be, you know, we have this huge military bloc, you know, the rogue Russians try to rise up, but, you know, this demonstrates the value of NATO, and, you know, NATO will be more important than ever before. However, if the US and NATO fails in this conflict, then a new narrative will come up, the one you're seeing now in Prague, the one that NATO is a security institution, which is, you know, it exists to deal with the problems caused by its own existence. And, you know, we should have made a post-Cold War peace agreements with the Russians instead. And you will see then, because NATO causes these problems but are unable to actually win and protect us, then you will see probably more countries breaking off a little bit, like Hungary, trying to seek their own peace with Russia. And in this instance, you will see NATO severely weakened. So whether or not you're going to have a NATO-dominated Europe or a weakened NATO, it all depends on this. This is why this conflict is so dangerous, because both sides have bet everything on this, and they have everything to lose or everything to win.
I would partly disagree with you, because for Russia, its existential interests are on the line. I'm not sure that America's or even Europe's existential interests are engaged here economically, but for the Americans, it's not a matter of their survival, unlike it is for the Russians.
No, I think the Americans are fighting down to the last Ukrainian and down to the last euro in this conflict. So I agree with that aspect. And I also agree that Russia considering this to be an existential threat is also very reasonable. It's never clear to me what they think Russia's supposed to do. If Russia, you know, even pulls out where it was on the 23rd of February, you will see NATO and US military hardware follow it. So it's going to be, this has been recognized by Russia to be an existential threat for 20 years, which we ignored. What I mean is that it's become an existential threat for NATO. I think NATO's entire political legitimacy has been put on the line. But, of course, you can't necessarily compare that to an existential threat to...
But NATO is just as an organization. At the end of the day, it's supposed to be serving the interests of the populations it represents, which brings me to my final question. Here at the forum, you will hear a lot of Russian and Chinese and Indian speakers talk about being proud about lifting, you know, millions of people out of poverty. In the East, that's considered the main goal, the main purpose of state policy, both domestic and international. But it seems that in the West, decision makers are ready to sacrifice people's living standards, people's basic economic necessities for the sake of conducting their foreign policy. Is that a sustainable arrangement? How long do you think it will take for the Europeans to actually, you know, bring their governments, their decision makers to the account and tell them that, you know, we elect you first and foremost to make our lives better and not worse?
Well, I think that, yes, we talked about before, I think this is a part of the curse of the unipolar order, which is when we had all this power concentrated in the West during the 90s, the problem is you can afford to make a lot of silly mistakes. So, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, we've kind of been able to do this, and we've been able to absorb all the blows and absorb the cost. And I think that we always assume that, you know, we can absorb all of this. So I think we're reaching the breaking point now. This, you know, we can't take on more debt. We can't have more unfavorable trade gaps. I think this has kind of blinded us a bit to the pain we're able to absorb. I think in other countries, they have to stay a bit more focused, being India, China, to make sure that they protect the base, the living standard at home, you know, before they go on to this kind of adventurism. But I think that we might move there towards, at least in Europe as well. Again, you do see the backlash. that countries are now starting to rethink, well, at least the population, whether or not this has been a great idea. Like, why not just go back to where this began, the problems, which was the early 1990s, when we failed to establish a mutually acceptable Cold War, post-Cold War security system with Russia, and, you know, deal with the core of the issue, which isn't good countries versus bad, but rather that we have a European security architecture which is put in complete zero sum. So I think as soon as we give up on the idea that we can simply break the Russians, then, you know, hopefully we can start to move somewhere more productive. And I think at the end of the day, it will probably be the European citizens feeling a lot of pain, which will be trying to remove governments which, you know, go against this, what I would think would be an obvious and sensible objective.
Well, Professor Dizon, this is all we have time for. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.